You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. A new report from the Massachusetts Department of Public Health shows that opioid-related deaths are down 5% compared to this time last year. And opioid prescriptions have also dropped pretty dramatically here in the Commonwealth and nationwide. Still, the opioid epidemic is far from over, and the pace of research is, if anything, picking up. Joining me to discuss all of this is Michael Botticelli. He's executive director of the Graykin Center for Addiction at Boston Medical Center. Before that, he served as the director of National Drug Control Policy at the White House under President Obama. Michael, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thanks, Heather. Good to be with you today.
5% drop in opioid-related deaths in 1 year. How significant is that, and do we know what's behind that?
Well, I think there's some good news in the report in that we've seen some declines, not only in the first quarter of this year, but that's against some declines that the state saw in 2017. And that's this, you know, those declines are after decades of year upon year increase in overdose deaths. So while I certainly do not think it's any cause for celebration, I think that it is some indication that some of the strategies here are beginning to take hold. I will say that I think there were some also disturbing data in that report in terms of the significant increases that we've seen in overdose deaths over the past few years among African Americans, and even though it leveled off among Hispanics. Again, while that decline appears to be primarily for white people in the Commonwealth, the data and the report also, I think, give us some considerable cause for pause and for making sure that we're rethinking our strategies here to make sure that they're reaching everybody who's been impacted.
The Commonwealth has implemented a number of new policies and beefed up a number of programs when it comes to addiction treatment. Do you have a sense of which of those policies might be responsible for some of this drop and which ones might need to be further improved in order to address, as you were saying, the increase in deaths that we've seen among the African-American population and the fact that deaths are not dropping in the same way among the Hispanic population?
Well, you know, let me say, first of all, that we know that this is a complex epidemic that was caused by a wide variety of factors. And our response to this has to be a multifaceted and comprehensive response. There are no silver bullets here. And while I think that we can begin to point to some activities and strategies that may be having an impact, I think it's actually really a combination of a wide variety of strategies that really need to be in place over a period of time if we want to have some sustained impact. I think clearly the Commonwealth has done a very good job around naloxone distribution. I think you know naloxone is the drug that reverses an overdose, so there's been a significant amount of effort in supporting people who are in a position to reverse an overdose use naloxone. And given that there still seems to be an increase in non-fatal overdoses, I think leads someone to believe that maybe the decrease is a function of more widespread naloxone distribution. But we've also seen, I think, significant efforts to increase treatment capacity in the Commonwealth, to lower prescribing, which we know was one of the main drivers that started this epidemic in the first place, and a number of other strategies. So I think it's really hard to isolate out kind of one specific thing that may be attributing to this decrease.
There's some new research from your center at Boston Medical Center showing just how strong the influence of pharmaceutical companies, their marketing, the whining and dining of doctors, how much that can influence prescriptions. And you were just noting, you know, that that's one of the main ways that people get introduced to opioids. And we have seen a pretty significant reduction, a 30% drop in opioid prescriptions in Massachusetts since 2015. But you're still seeing this effect where, I mean, just as much as one meal can measurably increase the number of prescriptions that a doctor writes in the following year.
I think this is a really important study. And while there has been some significant attention and litigation at the role that manufacturers and distributors of opioid medication have played in this epidemic. I think what's important about this study is it shows that physicians and payments to physicians, even small payments, can have a direct impact on their opioid prescribing behavior. So I think what it says is a number of things that I certainly would call on the pharmaceutical manufacturers and sales folks to stop the practice of providing those kinds of reimbursements. But I think it's also incumbent on physicians to make sure that there are kind of no incentives that can keep supporting the overprescribing of opioids. So I think this is a real call to physicians think about kind of the moral and ethical issues in taking some level of payment, even as small as a meal, from a pharmaceutical opioid manufacturer and salespeople.
I'm talking with Michael Botticelli. He's executive director of the Graykin Center for Addiction at Boston Medical Center. How much of opioid prescribing is over-prescribing, as you were just saying, and how much of it is simply that we don't have a good alternative and patients do need pain management?
Well, you know, one of the things that we have learned through numerous studies that particularly for people with acute pain, that giving long duration of opioid prescribing and very high dosages of opioid prescribing significantly increase the chance that people will develop a problem. So part of the efforts, largely supported through the CDC guidelines around prescribing, call for short duration dosage and as low strength dosage as possible to minimize opportunities for problems. But I think you also raise an important point here that, you know, just because we want to diminish the volume of opioids that are being prescribed, this should not hamper our efforts to make sure that patients are getting good access to evidence-based pain management therapies.
Such as what?
Things like acupuncture and physical therapy cognitive behavioral therapy are a few examples of those pain management programs that we should be implementing as we are simultaneously looking to reduce the volume of opioids that are being prescribed.
Are you aware of anyone tracking whether or not those alternative kinds of pain management techniques are actually gaining traction, increasing in frequency, and being prescribed or suggested by doctors?
I don't. I haven't seen data to really look at that. But I will tell you that I think it's really important to know that in Massachusetts, our state Medicaid program actually does reimburse for a number of those non-pharmacologic pain strategies. And I will tell you that that is not true across the country. I saw a study that showed that only about 50% of state Medicaid programs are actually reimbursing for those services.
Reducing the number of opioid prescriptions and using some of these alternative pain management techniques, we would expect would eventually decrease the addiction rate. And we've got naloxone now much more broadly available to try to prevent opioid-related deaths. Somewhere in the middle, though, is treatment for those currently struggling with addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And medically assisted treatment is something that has been particularly controversial. Where does that stand, both in terms of research and the options that are available to patients, and also the policies and the framework for making sure that people have access to medically assisted treatment?
So I would first start by saying that that controversy is not based in any scientific evidence or in the literature and experience of patients. Quite honestly, we know that treating an opioid use disorder with one of the three FDA-approved medications, naloxone, methadone, and buprenorphine, is shown to be much more highly effective at diminishing cravings and keeping people on a path to recovery than treatment without them. Unfortunately, what we see in Massachusetts and around the country is a dramatic underutilization of those medications in our criminal justice system, in our treatment system, and even within our primary care and medical services. So we really have to, I think, do a better job of basically ensuring that anyone with an opioid use disorder is offered one of those medications, as well as being supported by other behavioral and recovery support therapies. You know, we know that medication is really important, but people need more than just medications if we want to see them have a healthy life. But I do think that, unfortunately, we are not seeing as good uptake on these medications as we should be based on the evidence.
What are some of the biggest open questions that the research community needs to address? And how much of this is a research problem? Or is this really an issue where we know what we need to do and we just need to start implementing policies?
I would say it's both, but I would tip the scales in favor of understanding and implementing all of those things that we know to be effective. I think while research and innovation will always be important in our work, and particularly with this epidemic, you know, as we see this kind of morph as it's gone along, I think that kind of research and evaluation and innovation are incredibly important. But I will say that, you know, over the past 50 years, you know, we have had significant research on things that are effective, effective prevention programs, intervention programs. Certainly, we have highly effective treatment. That's when it's done in a high quality way, really can support long-term recovery. So I think our immediate goal, quite honestly, has to be focused on how do we implement all of those things that we already know to be effective.
That's Michael Botticelli. He's executive director of the Graykin Center for Addiction at Boston Medical Center. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Good to be with you today, Heather. Thank you.
Up next, researchers have figured out where the fungus that's been killing frogs actually came from. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.